Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Welcome to the October 2021 term of SCOTUSCast. I'm your host, Nick Garfinkel, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. On October 6th, the court heard oral arguments in United States v. Zubaida, a case which concerned whether the Ninth Circuit erred when it rejected the United States' assertion of state secrets privilege on the court's own assessment of potential harms to national security. Joining us today to discuss this decision in two parts is Kate Comerford Todd, managing partner at Ellis George Cipollone in Washington, D.C. Ms. Todd formerly served as deputy counsel to the Office of the President, chief counsel for the U.S. Chamber Litigation Center, and has held teaching positions at both George Washington University Law School and Cornell. Ms. Todd is also clerk for Justice Clarence Thomas and Judge Michael Luttig of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, and is a graduate of Harvard Law School. Ms. Todd will begin her commentary with background and significance of the case, and then move on to coverage of oral argument.
In this particular matter, a respondent was captured post 9/11 in Pakistan, detained in CIA black sites, and subjected to enhanced interrogation. There's no question about that, repeated waterboarding, other techniques that were part of that program before eventually being transferred to Gitmo and where he still is in custody. He sought to compel discovery from two former CIA contractors, a psychologist who was sort of behind this program for use in a criminal investigation taking place in Poland by Polish prosecutors. And as the government describes it, is seeking to confirm or deny whether the CIA operated a detention facility in Poland during the relevant period, so in the early 2000s. The alleged use of these interrogation techniques at that facility to the extent it existed, and the details of respondents' treatment, again, in that facility, assuming it existed in Poland. On the one hand, there's been significant disclosure of the CIA program, including declassified CIA documents that go into some detail of the treatment of respondent himself, discovery in a different civil case involving these same two contractors that described some of the interrogation, a decision which I think will end up coming to play in the oral argument at the court by the European Court of Human Rights that seemed to take the Polish government's refusal to confirm or deny and turn that into an inference and ultimately a conclusion that yes, of course, there must have been one of these black sites operated in Poland that related to respondent, as well as a Senate Select Committee intelligence report that did a comprehensive review. So you've got a lot out there that is very detailed about respondent. On the other hand, the US government has repeatedly across administrations rejected the IMLAT requests. Those are the mutual legal assistance treaty requests, government-to-government transfer of information from the Polish prosecutors, and has never confirmed where the particular black sites were located. So the district court found that yes, there was still some information, despite a lot of speculation and a lot of reporting of some information, there was still significant information that was being sought here that should be protected by the state secrets privilege, which is how the government responded, motions to quash the subpoenas of these individuals based on state secrets. But then also acknowledge there may be some of that information that is being sought that is really already in the public domain, but ultimately concluded when you look at it, that information isn't really what is going to be useful to the Polish prosecutors, and there is a risk that you will actually end up having revelations related to that information that is protected by state secrets in the course of trying to sort of winnow this down. So the district court took the step of just cutting off the discovery altogether. A divided panel of the Ninth Circuit would reverse and send back with a heavy hand toward allowing the discovery to move forward. rehearing was denied in this case, but had a very notable, strong 12-judge dissent, which didn't even include two of the Trump judges who had not participated in the case. So the Trump administration filed the cert petition, followed up by the Biden administration filing the reply and the merits briefing, all taking the same view as to the Ninth Circuit, that the Ninth Circuit had gone too far in imposing its own judgment, not provided the a proper amount of deference to the CIA's assessment of what the national security risk was, sort of making too much of the fact that these were contractors and not government officials. And then also just arguing that the discovery in this type of a proceeding, which I'll get to in a second, is just the wrong place to try to dabble with information that may ultimately have a state secret element to it. So what should we be watching for when this case is argued? You know, as I said, this was a topside U.S. government request for cert, strong national security interests, further supported through a change of administration. It makes it a strong case for cert no matter what. So I don't think we can assume the court necessarily took it to reverse, which we often do when there are Ninth Circuit grants. But I do think there are two things that may trouble a majority of the justices here. The first is this sort of logical, intuitive notion that it's precisely official confirmation of speculation about Poland's involvement that respondent is seeking. If what was already in the public domain is taken as fact, it's not clear why the Polish prosecutors would need more. Now, I should disclaim at this point that I have no insider information about this case, despite my government service, but I do have some experience with information being widely reported and there being multiple purported sources who confirm it, and it can be nonetheless false. So I just put that out there. And I think most people who've lived in this town, worked in this town, and potentially some justices at the Supreme Court have witnessed that experience too. And so I just think it's important to kind of keep in mind as the court is looking at, is there still a nugget of a secret left here sufficient to be protected? And the second thing about this case is it's procedural posture. This is a Section 1782 request, which means there's no underlying case filed in a U.S. federal court. There's no underlying case or controversy in a traditional Article III sense. So there would be no Article III judge that is in sort of continued monitoring of how any information that is gleaned through this compulsory process might be used in an ongoing basis. And so I think that you know, given that it's got that overlay and the government is making much of that, that you'll see a lot of questioning by the justices about how exactly we feel about using this slightly odd mechanism, although has existed for a long time, to hand over information that potentially gets near state secrets, which is ultimately why the district court made the decision that it did. The only other thing I'll say about this case is just sort of stepping back and looking at the context. You know, there are undoubtedly strong emotions surrounding the CIA's now ended enhanced interrogation program, of which respondent was a part. And respondent did assemble a very powerful lineup of amici to chronicle that treatment. The case is also being heard when memories of 9/11 are probably at their strongest that they have been in quite a few years. You had Biden officials on the Hill this week talking about how the war on terror is very much alive and ongoing. And you have not just the Trump and Biden administrations continuing to invoke the need for state secret privilege here, but you know, would have included Obama and Bush before that. And so I think you know, that's another element to sort of watch and what might be the backdrop. And finally, just note that there's another case involving state secrets that will be argued in November. So I think we may see these cases aren't before the court very frequently. So we will get some insight perhaps into how the justices are viewing state secrets more broadly that might relate to that case.
This concludes the first segment of United States versus Zubaida. Thank you to Ms. Todd for her careful coverage of background and significance of the issue. In the following segment, we'll hear more specific analysis of oral argument.
Argument in United States versus Zubaida, through both the government's opening and respondent's argument, focused primarily on the issues one would expect, but it then took a very unusual turn in the government's rebuttal and in post-argument letters to the court. I'll spend just a minute on the ordinary and then turn to the extraordinary. As to the government's opening argument, the justices did precisely what one would expect, pressing the government on what was still secret, probing how much deference to give the executive and on what determinations, and pushing on why some sort of limited inquiry couldn't go forward. Justice Sotomayor expressed some comfort with the government's Section 1782 argument, or at least seemed more comfortable in that line than on the pure state secrets argument, and noted the government's denial of IMLAT requests held some force. Recall, those are the government-to-government requests for cooperation done pursuant to treaty. When respondents' counsel was on deck, the justices pressed counsel hard on what precisely respondent was seeking from the government, if not official confirmation of location, that specific acts took place in Poland. Or, as Justice Kagan suggested, that specific acts took place at a time later than is publicly reported that could match up with dates alleged to have coincided with a holding in Poland. If not for the rebuttal, the most interesting moment may have been counsel's use of a murder on the Orient Express as a way to illustrate witness challenges across geographic lines. And there was a moment when Justice Breyer asked why respondent himself, Zubaida, couldn't provide his first-hand account to the Polish prosecutor to aid in its investigation. This is important. Next comes the government's rebuttal, and enter Justice Gorsuch with a direct follow-up to the government, asking the government whether it would allow Zubaida to provide his account of his treatment. Justice Breyer and Sotomayor added to that request forcefully, urging counsel to answer whether the government would commit to making Zubaida's statement available to the Polish government without invoking state secrets over its content. Why is this extraordinary? Because respondents didn't seek this action in this litigation. This is a 1782 request for testimony from former government contractors. Because, as Justice Alito helped guide counsel to explain, this is not the type of thing counsel for the government could commit to without consulting his client. In answer to the questions posed in rebuttal, the United States followed up with a letter explaining that it had previously denied Zubaida's participation in the Polish inquiry via the IMLAT process, and there are restrictions on the types of communications Guantanamo detainees can provide outside of their habeas proceedings. Nonetheless, the government agreed to permit Zubaida to provide a declaration, but any such declaration would have to go through the screening process established for all detainees. Respondents' counsel responded with a letter protesting that the government's concession isn't really much of a concession if the declaration is redacted for the very information the government believes is subject to state secrets. But the letter goes on to put the extraordinary nature of the court's request in the starkest relief, asking for the court to hold the case in abeyance to send back to the district court, for the district court potentially to appoint a special master to deal with this novel declaration issue. What's going on here? This entire exchange raises more questions than it answers, and here are just a few. Why did the government make this concession? Did it view it as strategically necessary? Or does this reveal a crack between the Biden administration and the three prior administrations that had either initiated actions against Zubaida or rejected the IMLAT requests and or invoked the state secrets defense? Now what does the court do? Does what started as general questions set the stage for micromanaging a larger legal issue for which respondents' counsel chose a different legal strategy in the litigation below? Even respondents' counsel seems to concede in his letter that it's not clear how such a declaration would affect the case at hand. How would it? Can the court now overlook this entire line of inquiry and reach a decision on Section 1782 and simply suggest respondents' counsel take up the government's offer in a separate proceeding? In the same proceeding? How many separate decisions will this case yield, and on what alignments? This case may not be in the top five of hot cases already granted this term, but it is most definitely one to watch, as much for the new twist of the court's own making as for any final legal conclusions on Section 1782 or state secrets.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.